the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. A lot of things we're going to cover today, and especially one very important for many of you who either are working in the education system or in the private sector.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest today on the program is Dr. Jeremy Walston from Johns Hopkins University. The topic is staying fit and avoiding frailty as you grow older. A lot of times people associate the way people behave in certain age groups with the age itself, but it really isn't. It's associated more with how they take care of themselves as they age. You can avoid a lot of problems if you know how to do it.
And today we're going to cover a topic that hits many of you, and especially those that are getting ready for retirement, or some of you are already retired, and that's retirement plan distributions. Now, most Americans are contributing to some form of a retirement plan. You may be contributing to, let's say, a 401k plan at work. If you're in the private sector, which 401k plans have almost replaced a lot of the defined benefit plans that were prevalent, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. If you're in the education system, in addition to the state teacher's pension, you have something called a 403b plan. And if you work for the federal government, you have a 457 plan. There are a lot of issues regarding those retirement plans, rolling them over into an IRA, penalties that you may face for, let's say, early distributions or late distributions, and survivor and beneficiary options on those IRAs, and especially affecting taxation at death, whether it's income taxes or estate taxes. Now, I bet a lot of you aren't thinking about that, but there are so many laws, rules, and regulations. We could probably do the next month covering all of the issues involved. We're going to try to hit some of the main categories in today's program.
You have to recognize that retirement plan distributions are the product of the last few decades. If we go back to the baby boom generations and even our parents, the parents of the baby boomers, our parents had pensions and Social Security. But in the late 1970s, companies began doing away with defined benefit plans and replaced them with 401ks. These had a much different outcome. Our parents had predictable pensions. When you went to a company, a lot of times, Jim, you were there for life. You know, you married the company, not the company store, but you married into the company. It took care of you. You worked for 40 years. They gave you a crummy watch and you had a and you had a benefit plan when you got out of it, and it was pretty well established. But the 401ks changed all of that. The baby boomers were left to the whims of the marketplace as that all began to change. And since that time, we've been through two bear markets and 0% interest rates. And it is much more difficult to plan retirement because you can't tell exactly how well your 401k is doing, depending on where it's being invested.
And John, it's not just the investment options. When we think of our 401k plans, we're thinking of the money that we're going to invest. And then also, there's so many tax issues that are involved here. I don't think people believe or understand how complex this can be. We have the distribution options. You have things like Roth conversions. You also have penalties involved with distributions from a pension plan. Penalties if you take the money too early. Penalties if you take it too late, because later on in life, the government is going to require you to take a certain amount of income each year. You also have things like survivor and beneficiary options. And then, of course, at death, you have tax planning, not only during your lifetime when you're taking distributions, but also at death when both either yourself or your surviving spouse pass away. There's tax issues involved too. So it's not just whether you're going to roll it over or take an annuity. You have Roth conversion options, and you have penalties, survivor options, and taxation. So just like our tax law, everything regarding investments, income, and assets has truly become more complex today with today's convoluted tax laws.
Yeah, you do get the feeling after a while that you're jumping through a series of hoops. And what's even more exciting is that the hoops tend to change from time to time as new laws are passed and things are revoked. So you don't even have steady planning as you go. So one option is the annuity option over lifetime. Now, let's talk about the other option, the lump sum. And I would imagine if you took a lump sum, then you'd be free to do something with this. Like you say, the annuity ends at the end of your life, nothing for the heirs. But I'd also imagine there are rules governing this option. And so we have to look at when this would be appropriate and when you probably don't want to do it.
When you get ready to retire, let's assume you've spent X amount of years with the company. You're now getting ready to retire. You have a certain amount accumulated in your 401k plan, 403b, or 457 plan. Most retirement distribution plans offer two major options. One is to take them in a lump sum distribution, the entire amount. Usually you roll that over into something called an IRA rollover. The other option is a series of periodic payments, otherwise known as an annuity. So instead of taking it a lump sum, basically you're going to get a monthly income over your entire lifetime. It's unlikely to change. It'll be a certain amount. And then there will also be some kind of beneficiary option to, let's say, a surviving spouse. Now, there's a host of laws governing distributions and what we call elective deferrals. And it gets quite complex, but basically you have things like elective deferrals, which can be made upon a participant's death if there's a case of disability or separation from service or severance from employment, and takes into account hardship options. In-service withdrawals are generally available to 401k plans due to, let's say, a person's hardship or unforeseen financial emergency under special provisions known as what we call hardship withdrawal rules. And under the hardship rules, withdrawals are available only from elective deferrals. A 401k plan can get financial aid. And there are a number of areas that these elections are allowed. For example, medical expenses for a parent spouse, purchase of a primary distribution, tuition payments for a child. I mean, there's a whole list of different options that are available. For example, even funeral expenses. And the thing is, if you elect that, the amounts aren't subject to this 10% early withdrawal option. And many of these are available to 401k participants. And in some cases, you can see this in 457 plans and 403b plans. But the distribution options, and you can even get in certain plans, depending on how your employer set up the plan, you can even take a loan from your 401k if there are loan provisions provided when the plan is set up. So there are a number of ways you can tap into your 401k plan prior to retirement in the case of election withdrawals due to hardship or other various reasons that you would need to tap in, or in some cases, even a loan or special provisions. If you're a first-time home buyer, this was one popular option that we saw in the last decade and also during this go-around with the drop in housing prices following the financial crisis.
So outside of these hardship options, what are the rules for lump sum versus annuity payments?
Well, let's look at the annuity option, because this used to be a very popular option. In fact, when we look at John, basically our parents who got, let's say, pensions, essentially what companies were doing is they were putting money aside for their employees based on so many years of service and based on what that person's salary was. They were accumulating money in a retirement plan, much like you are doing today in your 401k plan. And what they would do is they would go to an insurance company, let's say at your time of retirement, and they'd say, all right, here's a bucket of money that we put aside for, let's say, John Jones. Let's say it's $500,000 or $1 million, whatever the figure is. And let's say John is age 65 or 66, his wife is age 62. What are the various annuity options? When you elect to have an annuity option, you are going to get the equivalent of a pension. You're going to get a monthly distribution amount that's going to be the same for your entire lifetime and that of your spouse, depending on the various elections that are offered. You can get options based on your life only, or your life and 100% to your wife, 75% to your wife, 50% to your wife or spouse in this case. So what you're doing here is you're going to take, rather than managing the money, rather than trying to invest it yourself, you're turning it over to the company and say, hey, look, I just want a check every month. I want that to be a predictable check. And that's the annuity option. So you're not taking a lump sum. It's really important here, because we'll talk about this when we get to beneficiary options, that you really study your cash flow in retirement in terms of how much you're going to take and leave to your spouse, whether it's going to be 100% of your pension, 75% or 50%. Usually, Most plans will have a 100% option to a surviving spouse, 75 and 50%. Now, you have to think about this. If you are retired and you're getting Social Security, your wife is getting Social Security. Let's say you're the main breadwinner. In most cases, if something happens to you, your Social Security is probably larger. Your wife can elect to take your Social Security, but what's going to happen at your death, she'll take yours, but she will forfeit her own Social Security, so she's going to lose a source of income. So you got to be real careful on the beneficiary options of choosing a lesser amount to a surviving spouse, because he's going to lose their Social Security benefits if they elect to take the larger amount of the deceased spouse's Social Security. So here's the problem. Once you elect an annuity, you can't change it. The risk that you're taking here is you're taking an annuity, which is really a return of principal, your own money back, plus a rate of return, and you're doing so today at probably the lowest interest rates that we've seen in 60 years. And the other thing is, when you pass away, or that of your spouse, if you elect to have your distributions continue to your spouse, there's nothing left for your heirs. Basically, the money's all gone. So in many cases, this is an appropriate option when there's not enough assets to invest to cover retirement needs, and you're not concerned with leaving assets to the heirs. In some cases, it may be the best choice, given your need for income and the amount of available assets to support you during your retirement.
So one option is the annuity option. That's over a lifetime. Let's talk about the other one. That's the lump sum. And I'm guessing that there are probably rules governing this option, and as to when it's appropriate is important.
Well, not only is it appropriate, John, the one thing is most plans, if you have more than $5,000 of assets, have to allow you the option to roll over the assets. And there's a number of rules that apply to this. For example, whether you have a SEP IRA, a simple IRA, or a Roth IRA, if you roll over, let's say, your 401k, you can roll it over to an IRA. That's an option. You can roll it over to a SEP IRA or a simple IRA, and even a Roth IRA. We'll talk about that in a moment. Now, if you have a SEP IRA, you can roll it over into an IRA rollover. You can roll it over into another SEP IRA, but you can't roll it over into a simple IRA, but you can to a Roth IRA. If you have a rollover from a simple IRA, you can roll it over to an IRA, a SEP IRA, and even a simple IRA. And if you have a rollover from a Roth IRA, you cannot roll it over to a Roth because you already paid the tax, and you can't roll it over to a SEP or a simple IRA. The only thing you're allowed if you have a Roth IRA is you can roll it over into another Roth. Now, there's a whole number of distributions here that are permitted, rollovers from simple IRAs, from Roth IRAs, from 401, 403b plans, 457 plans. The rules are pretty much the same, and I don't want to take the next 10, 15 minutes reading all the rules, but most of the time, if you have a simple 401k or you have a SEP IRA or a rollover IRA, you can roll it over to another like IRA. And in cases, if you're willing to pay the tax, you can roll it over to a Roth. We'll talk about the Roth in just a moment.
Yeah, let's talk about the Roth, because this can accumulate on a tax-free basis.
Yeah, effective beginning in 2010, there was a law passed in 2006 that eliminated the $100,000 of adjusted gross income. It used to be, under the old laws, if you made over $100,000 of income, you weren't allowed to cash in your IRA and roll it over into a Roth where it could accumulate tax-free. Now, beginning in 2010, there is no AGI or adjusted gross income rule. It doesn't matter what your income is today. You can roll it over into a Roth. And one of the reasons they did that, John, is remember, back in 2010, we were running trillion-dollar deficits. So if you roll over your 401k plan into a Roth IRA, you're going to pay the tax up front. Now, there is no 10% penalty, but you must pay the tax on the amount of the rollover, and the tax can be somewhat significant. And depending on the size of your 401k program, that can be a significant amount of tax and push you into a very, very high tax bracket, especially the difference today with tax rates under the Obama tax and the Bush tax. Now, if you want to roll it over into a Roth, there are some rules. You have to leave it there for 5 years. If you want to take it out eventually, tax-free. And I have found when you take a look at analyze this from the upfront taxes that you have to pay, the Roth is very effective when the amount isn't very large, so it's not going to push you in a huge tax bracket. And you have a long period to compound and accumulate that income. Because remember, for many of you, you may lose a third to up to 50%, depending on your tax bracket, of the amount that you roll over into a Roth, and you're going to pay that tax up front in the year that you do it. So you have to think about, boy, if I'm going to pay a third of my 401k program up front in the form of taxes, how long is it going to take me to make up just what I pay in taxes up front? And especially in an environment today where the markets are a little bit more uncertain, the rate of return on bonds are the lowest it's been in 60 years, you really got to think that through, because unfortunately you pay the tax up front. And here's the other thing, John, I'm just a little suspicious of. Under the Roth rules, if you leave the money in there, accumulate it for 5 years, you can take the money out tax-free. No income tax when you take the money out. But remember, John, you remember when Social Security used to be tax-free?
Yeah, I mean, that's before our governments always start to renege on the promises they make, but go ahead.
Yeah, because when Social Security was originally set up, you were putting your own money into the plan and you're basically taking the money out. Most people getting Social Security payments today who have paid into the program for 30 years are really paying tax on their own income. Originally, it was tax-free. Then in the 80s, with tax reform, you had to pay tax on 50% of the benefits if your income exceeded a certain level. And then with Bill Clinton, the tax included up to 85% of your Social Security is subject to taxation depending on your income. So here's an example of something that used to be tax-free that later became subject to up to 50% taxation, and up to 85% would be included in taxation. So don't be surprised. And John, you know the way they'll do it too. You could just see it that they'll be demonizing rich people, and they'll say, oh, these people that have these Roth IRAs, they're getting all their money tax-free. They're not paying their fair share. So always be a little bit leery of government keeping their promises, because we know they always break them. You know, John, for most individuals, and especially when you have large 401ks, it's probably going to make more sense to roll it over to an IRA, because you really don't want to pay a third or 50% of it up front in the form of taxes. I mean, especially in this kind of market, can you imagine if you had to pay a third or a half of it in taxes up front, how long it's going to take you just to break even to make up the taxes? So for larger IRAs, it probably makes more sense to roll it over, larger 401ks, roll it over into an IRA. It's going to do a number of things. Number one, it gives you more control over the assets and the outcome. Number two, you're not going to pay all those taxes up front. And number three, it gives you the ability to accumulate those assets and pass those assets onto your heirs, especially if you have children.
Okay, now here's the fun part about having to jump through hoops. What about penalties? I mean, there are some if you take it too early and others if you take it too late, so timing seems to be a big issue.
Yep. Never underestimate complexity when it comes to pension plans. They've changed these rules so many times over the years, but two of them have been somewhat consistent. Number one, if you take distributions from your IRA prior to age 59 and a half, there's a 10% penalty. That's pretty much been in place for decades now. The other one is at age 70 and a half, you have to begin mandatory distributions from your IRA. Those two rules pretty much haven't changed over the last several decades. Now, you can avoid the 10% penalty tax if you elect something called periodic payments. Basically, you're going to annuitize. Let's say you're age 54, you got early retirement, you want to access your IRA, you want to avoid the 10% penalty plus the regular taxes. What you would do is you would annuitize it, meaning you would take periodic distributions based on your life expectancy. The other rule comes into effect at age 70 and a half. And here is something you have to be really careful of, because April 1st, in the year you turn 70 and a half, you have to begin mandatory distributions. Now here, the penalties can be quite steep. Let's say that, I don't know, your IRA distribution, you're required to take a $20,000 distribution based on your age and the amount. I'm just using this for illustration. But let's say for whatever reason, you have so many IRAs, you forget to take the distribution based on all your IRAs, you only take out $10,000. Here, the under withdrawal, there is a 50% penalty, folks. This is on top of the tax, a 50% penalty on the required distribution versus what you took out. And believe it or not, it happens, and I've seen it happen over and over again, especially with people that have IRAs scattered all over the place. Let's say you have five or six IRAs, and you only take the IRA distribution based on one or two IRAs, you can get yourself in trouble. I had one case, John, between a husband and wife. They literally had over 10 different IRAs between mutual fund companies, banks, CDs, and different investment accounts. 10 different IRAs, and they got whacked pretty hard when they turned age 70 and a half. Nobody really contacted them to tell them that, hey, you have to take a distribution here. Now, many companies today, most brokerage firms will contact you usually in December, and if you have a registered rep, they should be on top of this so that they alert you and say, hey, you're 70 and a half. You got to take a mandatory distribution. It's already been calculated. This is what the amount is, and it's a good way to avoid it. But it's one reason to consolidate IRAs the closer you get to age 70 and a half, because you want to avoid that 50% penalty, because it could be quite steep.
All right. Well, what about beneficiaries and pension plans, especially when the person who has the pension passes on?
Well, there are beneficiary provisions. Usually it goes to the spouse, unless you don't like your spouse. And then if you want to avoid making them beneficiary, you're going to have to go through hoops, and especially in a situation where you're excluding your spouse.
What about pets? Maybe you could will it to your dog or something like that.
Well, if you don't have a spouse, yeah, I'm not sure how the pet would be taken care of. No, I mean, I've seen cases where people have left. They have a dog or a particular animal that they have left provisions in their will for taking care of that particular pet. That is not uncommon. Seen it often. But generally, if you have an IRA, it's usually going to go to the spouse, or maybe to children, or to your trust, or you have things like quadro, which are basically come into play with, let's say, a divorce. And then you also have to deal with something most people don't expect, and that's final taxation. Now, if you have children, you can use something called an IRA stretch, where your IRA is going to be, rather than taxed in year of death, it's going to be stretched out over your beneficiary, in this case, children's life expectancy. So it'll be taxed at a lower rate. However, if you don't plan for it properly, that IRA could be subject to income taxes in the year of death. And in figure, folks, if you have a large IRA, let's say it's $500,000 or more, or $1 million, it could be subject up to 44% federal tax. Here in California, 13%. It's very, very important, if your IRA is over $500,000 or $1 million, to avoid substantial shrinkage due to taxation. I can remember, John, back before the exemption on estates was $5.3 million as it is today, it used to be $1 million. And I can remember back in the 90s, a very wealthy estate where the government took over 70% of this successful entrepreneur's pension plan, which had been rolled over into an IRA when he sold his business and he retired. The combination of federal taxes, state of California taxes back then 9.3%, and in the 90s 39.6% under the Clinton tax rate. So 39.6 for federal, 9.3 state of California, and then the estate taxes of 55%. In this particular case, you can imagine having to explain to the heirs, because this individual did not do some proper planning, the government ended up taking 70% of this wealthy individual's retirement plan because of lack of planning. So there are a lot of important issues, not just on the distribution, but also the beneficiaries and taxation upon death.
Sounds like this is a lot more complicated than you would think, especially if you're just jumping into it. I mean, the tax laws are pretty complicated, covering distributions and rollovers. That's another reason to take time to study the alternatives. You need to come up with a plan. I mean, this is obvious if you want to avoid penalties, but whatever you do make in the way of choices, they do have permanent effects.
Yeah, I mean, you really need to study the alternatives. I mean, I can write a book on some of the horror stories I've seen over three decades of doing retirement planning. The 70% tax issue on a particular couple in the last decade, the successful entrepreneur that sold his business. I mean, the combination of federal taxes, state taxes, and estate taxes, I mean, it really wiped out a good majority of what was lifetime savings in a pension plan. And in most cases, in most pensions, I even saw a case where the pension there was an annuity option an individual took for maximum distribution during his retirement years, John, but he left no beneficiary to his wife. So when he passed away, his wife lost his pension, not to mention losing her own Social Security, because a spouse can take her husband's Social Security if he was the main breadwinner, and that Social Security was larger than her own. But in this particular case, in this instance, not only did this particular surviving spouse lose her Social Security, electing to take her husband's, but her husband left none of his pension to his wife. He elected to take maximum distribution or maximum amount during his lifetime. So this spouse was hit particularly hard with the passing of her husband. And I don't think he fully realized what he did when he retired when this happened. Another issue that we've seen is IRAs can be taxed as a lump sum at death. All of these issues, John, believe it or not, can be avoided with some proper planning. It always amazes me how little planning is done with these distributions or the choices that are made, and they're going to affect you for the rest of your retirement, not to mention those that are beneficiaries or those that are your successors that come after you. Absolutely just amazes me at the amount of mistakes and the extra taxes or forfeitures that people go through because of lack of planning.
So, given your experience, if we had to generalize some guidelines rather than generating anxiety here, more security, rollovers versus annuity, allowing your IRA to accumulate rather than withdrawing early, there are so many options. And I know, Jim, anytime I've tried to get into things like this, after a while, your head's swimming and you just rather throw it all on the shredder and go watch a football game or something like that. Is there any guidelines sequence here we could generalize?
Well, a lot of it really, John, depends on the asset size of the 401k plan and also the available income sources that you can tap into to support your retirement income needs. Now, the larger amounts generally favor a rollover because, I mean, if it's a small amount, you could probably take a lump sum or annuitize or, let's say, pay the tax rolled over into a Roth IRA. Now, annuitization really comes into play when there's just deficient income. There's just not enough assets in today's low interest rate environment to support your income needs. Another factor could be health issues. I mean, if you are unhealthy, you don't want to elect an annuity option because depending on how you elect that option, whether you take annuity option in your life, spouse, or let's say a 10-year certain, so you guarantee certain payments, there's a risk there. Also, in today's lower interest rate environment, there's another risk that you're locking in to a distribution rate at some of the lowest interest rates that we've seen in probably 60 years. And remember, once you elect that option, you can't change it. It's cut in stone. You can't change it. Annuitization in these low interest rate environments are very dangerous, but sometimes it's the only option available to meet your retirement income needs. But the other thing is when you annuitize, you have no inflation safeguard. So hopefully you have other assets like dividend paying stocks or mutual funds that can grow over time to help take care of medical needs later on in retirement or just the basic inflation cost of living. So there are many variables here, but it's safe to say the larger amounts favor rollovers. And regarding Roth conversions, well, two factors go into effect. Usually that works well with smaller amounts. And number two, when you have a longer time period to allow those assets to accumulate tax-free to make up for the difference, you're going to pay up front in taxes.
Well, it seems like if you spend a lifetime accumulating this wealth towards your retirement, it only makes sense to consider all your options, not just rollovers and annuities, because there are penalties. You have to think about your beneficiaries who are going to be involved, but also taxation issues and when the tax is applied, if it is applied. So it's time to put today's program, what we've been discussing right now, into some practical experience, which we always do here on The Purpose. The case is a real case. The people, however, as far as their names are concerned, are fictitious. So here we move on to this week's case study, and they are...
We talked about this a couple of years ago, but I wanted to use this case study because it illustrates two points. One, annuitization of a 403b plan or the equivalent in the education system to a 401k, and a rollover of an IRA. And we'll call this the case study of Bill and Jan Smith. Bill, age 66, and was retired. His wife, 8 years younger than him, was age 58, and she was a teacher. Her salary was roughly about $80,000 a year, and she was getting ready to retire within a two-year period when she could take 66% of her salary in the form of a pension. Now, Bill retired in the year 2006, rolled over his 401k program into an IRA rollover. Unfortunately, most of it went into the stock market 2 years before the market peaked, and we all know what happened between 2007 and 2009. So what used to be a greater sized IRA lost money, which sent Bill and shocked him to some extent. And basically, when he came to see us, it was mainly invested in cash. And remember what this was like, folks. This was back in 2010 when people weren't expecting this recovery wasn't going as well as it was. Remember when the Fed was going to exit QE1 and then all of a sudden Bernanke changed his mind in the summer of 2010 and announced QE2 in the fall. So at the time of retirement, Bill's Social Security, when he came in to see me, was roughly about $1,450 a month, roughly about $1,704 a year. Jan's pension at 66 years after several decades as a teacher would be $54,000 a year. So total Social Security and pension would be $71,005. Unfortunately, their budget was $105,000. I know a lot of you that live in the Midwest are probably thinking, all those California folks. Well, when you live in California, the cost of living, housing, property taxes, sales taxes, gasoline taxes, just about everything you can think of. We're one of the most expensive states to live in outside the East Coast in New York. So their budget was $105,000. They had a shortfall of roughly about $33,500. Now, we got them to break their budget into essentials. Essentials was $90,000. And what we call the bucket list or quality of life issues like golf membership and travel, $10,000. And the want-to-haves were $5,000 that they were putting into education accounts for their grandchildren, and that made up $105,000 in the budget, with the essential budget being $90,000, less Social Security and pensions of $71,000. So they had a shortfall of roughly over $33,000.
And of course, when you talk about budgets, Jim, a lot of that's going to be influenced by where you live. California is a very expensive place to live. I can think of other states that would be that way. And so, you know, I think part of retirement planning is giving thought to some place that would reduce your budget, that reduces the strain. And then even if you have the same amount of money to work with, you'd have more surplus money to put in other areas.
Yeah, we did a couple case studies and actually a couple shows on that, what we call voluntary tax inversions. You heard about companies doing it. Well, individuals have been doing that for a long time. In fact, we discussed, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, John, where a considerable difference of savings was made by selling a home here in San Diego and moving to Sun City, Arizona, where the cost of housing was almost a third of what it was here in Southern California. Property taxes were lower, income taxes were lower, utilities were lower, just about everything you can think of was much lower, and it made a considerable difference in a person's lifestyle. But Bill and Jan, their friends are here, they're staying here, their kids are here. And so let's take a look at their assets. Basically, they had a home here in South Escondido, roughly at that time about $450,000. Now, this was a case study we did in 2010. And remember, we were just coming out of that housing downturn. I'm sure the home is worth a lot more than that today. Bill's IRA was $650,000, mainly in cash. That used to be an $800,000 IRA when he retired, but because of losses taken during the financial downturn, $650,000. Jan's 403b plan was roughly about $300,000. They had about $40,000 in the bank, so they had investment assets of $990,000, close to $1 million. Total assets of $1,004,000. Liabilities, they owed $300,000. This is going to be important when we get to the solution on that $450,000 home. Their net worth, little over $1 million. And you know, John, that's what we used to call millionaires in California. We used to call them a homeowner. But anyway, $1 million worth of assets. Sad to say, folks, $1 million doesn't buy the same kind of lifestyle it did 20 and 30 years ago. And I think we illustrated this in terms of investment returns. Because back at the turn of the century, in the year 2000, if you wanted $3,000 a month income, I could invested that money in a two-year treasury note, $540,000 would have produced $3,000 a month income. By 2006, with lower interest rates, it took $700,000 in two-year Treasury notes to produce $3,000 a month. Embrace yourself, folks. In the year 2014, it would take $8 million to produce $3,000 a month income. So when you say somebody's a millionaire, that millionaire doesn't have the same meaning it did 10, 20, 30 years ago.
It also seems pretty clear that Bill was shell-shocked when he began to see his IRA shrinking as a result of what was going on in the financial markets. And there was a significant age difference between Bill and Jan. Any other factors before you want to spring the solution on us?
There was one other consideration here. Bill had cardiovascular disease, clogged arteries, had a heart attack. You know, he lost weight, changed his diet, and he was taking medication. So far, that's been under control. But in addition to the 8 years difference between Jan and Bill, because this is going to factor in to the solution that we took a look at, trying to make up this $33,000 shortfall. But in addition to age, there was also the health issue between Bill and Jan, and also in Jan's family. They lived into their late 80s, and with a grandmother that lived into her 90s. And of course, as you mentioned, John, Bill's market fears, especially retiring in 2006 and 2 years later. Imagine what it's like. Here you are retired. You think you can live well. $800,000, a sizable amount of money, and still is. And then all of a sudden, we go through the financial crisis, probably the worst one we've seen since the Great Depression. Now, here were the two factors when we took a look at this in coming up with a solution, because we used three or four things in this particular plan. Number one, they had a budget of $105,000. Remember, folks, $90,000 was essential, $10,000 was vacations, golf, and $5,000 was annual gifts to their grandchildren's education. Against that, we had a little over $71,000 of income, which was $17,000 of Bill's Social Security, and Jan's pension as a teacher, $54,000. Now, what we did is, remember, Bill's shell-shocked. Remember, this is 2010. So we took $500,000 of Bill's IRA and put it into fixed income, a laddered bond portfolio at 4%. That produced $20,000 of income, and then $150,000 in dividend-paying stocks at 3% at that time. That was roughly $4,500. Now, here was a case where we used annuitization. We did it for two reasons. One, we had to make up the shortfall because Bill retired a couple of years earlier before Jan, and Jan, when she retired, would only get 66% of her salary as a teacher, so she was going to lose 34% of her salary, and that was a significant difference. So were we going to make that up? What we did is we took $230,000 of her 403b plan and we annuitized it on her life only. And we did that with the 10-year certain, meaning that if she got in a car accident, somehow came up with a disease that nobody expected and predeceased Bill, the payments would continue for 10 years. And by doing that, we got an annuity income of $2,000 a month or $24,000 a year. And that went a long ways of making up the difference between her salary and what she was going to get as a pension as a teacher. The balance of about $70,000 we took and put in dividend paying stocks. So for inflation hedges, we had $150,000 of Bill's 650 IRA and 70,000 of Jan's 403b, but we annuitized the bulk of it, 230,000, to create a predictable income stream that would not change. And the reason we did this on Jan's life is, number one, health issues with Bill, an age difference of 8 years, family health history of longevity on Jan's side. And to protect Bill in case of a premature death on Jan's part, we did a 10-year certain. So that produced $50,600 of income. Their total income was $122,000, less a budget of $105,000, leaving now, instead of a $33,000 deficit, a $17,000 surplus. The other thing that we did during the time with interest rates coming down, with Bernanke bringing down interest rates, is we refinanced the house on a 15-year mortgage versus a 30-year. And the idea was Jan wanted to keep the house, assuming that she was going to survive Bill. She wanted that house free and clear. It was on a golf course. They loved the game. They loved their neighbors. She didn't want to move. It was a small enough house, and she wanted to live there. The thing that we wanted to do is to make sure, given the age difference, that by the time that she was 73, that house would be free and clear, and we'd get rid of that payment. So we refinance the house. So as we take a look at this plan, Bill's health, they already had long-term care insurance. He took that out in the 50s. For inflation, we had dividend growth stocks. In terms of for Jan security, we refinanced the house at 3%, folks, of the 15-year mortgage. Just remember where interest rates were back then. To calm Bill's market fears, we put the bulk of his IRA in a laddered bond portfolio with 4% income. And to make up for a loss of income when Jan retired, the difference between her pension and salary, we turned part of her 403b plan into a monthly annuity that would last Jan her entire lifetime. So her security down the road with longevity and also the age difference was, number one, her annuity, and number two, at age 73, her house would be free and clear.
It did seem here, though, unlike some other cases, that there were a lot of options here. Bill was able to roll over into an IRA, and Jan was to take her annuity into a 403b plan. So there were some various options they could employ here.
Yeah, and this is the nice thing about putting together a plan, because you have so many options to take a look at. I mean, we looked at a single life annuity versus a joint annuity, and the difference between a single life annuity, and especially given Jan's younger age, because an insurance company takes a look at longevity. The younger you are, the longer the number of years of payment, the lower the amount was going to be. It was quite significant by going to a single life option, given the health issues and age difference between them, and it worked out quite nicely.
And that concludes this part of Lifetime Income for this week, but not to go away. Dr. Jeremy Walston is coming up next. Staying fit and avoiding, well, frailty as you move older and older. And you can only go in that direction because, unfortunately, the line of time only proceeds in one way. We'll be back.
We all know about the dangers of aging. Not keeping in shape or physical activity can bring harm later on in life. Frailty, falling, broken bones. What can you do to correct that? Joining me on the program is Dr. Jeremy Walston. He's from Johns Hopkins University. And Doctor, one of the things that we've seen, and I didn't realize it began this early, but in our early 40s, I guess, we begin to lose muscle. And I was surprised. I thought that was something that didn't happen until you were in your 50s or 60s.
It even happens earlier than the 40s. Sometime in the mid-30s, it looks like there's some molecular changes that start, and the muscle mass and muscle strength begins to decline. And it seems to most rapidly decline once people reach about age 70. So the decade between age 70 and 80, it appears to be a very rapid decline.
Doctor, is this one of the reasons why people begin to put on weight? I know men put on spare tires because you're not doing anything different. You're eating about the same level of food, and all of a sudden, you start gaining weight. Is it because you're losing muscle mass, which means your body metabolism is changing?
Well, that may be a part of it. There's probably more sort of complex molecular changes that are happening related to energy metabolism and the fact that you don't actually need as many calories. So somebody who, say, is age 30 might eat, for example, 3,000 calories. And the metabolism energy requirements of the whole body may go down a bit. And so say the person at age 40 is still eating 3,000 calories and they only need 2,800. And by age 50, they only need 2,500 and they're still eating 3,000. It begins to accumulate. And the way that these energy stores accumulate is through fat. Part of the issue may be that muscle is declining, which then slows down the metabolism because muscle is the tissue in the body that has the highest metabolic needs besides the brain. And the brain doesn't change much, but muscles change a lot and they need lots of energy.
Now, we see all over the place, you walk around, Americans tend to veer more towards being overweight, and yet you go around town, you see 24-hour fitness centers and all these health centers. Let's talk about what exercise and a healthy diet can do, and especially certain kinds of exercise that could prevent the kind of things that we're talking about, such as frailty.
Yeah, so there have been many, many studies done in older adults and younger adults over the years, and exercise has been time and time again to have huge influence on muscle strength, on gait walking speed, on quality of life indexes, how people feel about themselves, about their environment, just one positive impact after another. So it's known that it works. And really, even in the most frail and most older 60-year-old nursing home patients, it's been shown that physical activity and exercise make a difference in their quality of life and in their muscle strength. So the kinds of exercise that somebody might want to do, again, is a huge range. There can be aerobic exercise, which is running or working on a treadmill. That's really good for the cardiovascular system, the heart, the blood vessels, blood pressure, and the lower extremity muscles. So that's one group of exercise that should be included. There's more evidence now on actually muscle strength training as well. And those are usually the gyms that you see have lots of different muscle strength training equipment. And those appear to be quite helpful as well in maintaining strength in the lower extremities and the upper extremities, and especially in the shoulders, where older people have many more issues over the years. They begin to get weak and they have lots of kind of damaged tissues and they become less functional. So all those kinds of muscle strengthening exercises can make a big difference as well. And then finally, there are exercises related to balance and things like Tai Chi, which is a Chinese form of kind of balance and gait training. And those sorts of exercises have been shown to be very effective in preventing falls and improving balance in walking as people get older. And those have been studied more in the patients and subjects over age 70. So those are most effective in the older age ranges. But throughout the lifespan, like you said, exercise is really, really, really important.
Now, they even have a name for it. It's sarcopenia, I believe.
Yep. Sarcopenia is the loss of muscle mass, basically, age-related decline in muscle mass. And we've known about osteopenia or osteoporosis for many, many years. Women especially have been treated for that with medications. The muscle loss has been going on in parallel with the bone loss, but we haven't really focused on that in the research and clinical world, mostly because we haven't had any good treatment for it. But I think it's becoming widely recognized now that it plays a big role in the decline in function in older people, and we need to figure out better ways to manage it and prevent it.
Now, I've read some stories where they've taken people that have had muscle problems, frailty problems, and put them on a moderate, like, weightlifting program, and it's done tremendous wonders for getting them into better health.
Yeah, as I said earlier, those exercises related to weight training, muscle training, have been shown to be very important. It's not just aerobic exercise. It's these actual muscle training programs, like weightlifters, a modified version of what a weightlifter might do. And that keeps all the muscle groups stronger, depending on, you know, the types of exercise. And it's effective even in the oldest subgroup of people. So it needs to be supervised if somebody hasn't been doing it for a long time. A supervised, slow training regimen is the right way to go because it can injure joints and bones if you're not careful. But once people learn the right techniques and they're comfortable in the equipment, then it can make a huge difference in strength and, again, quality of life.
I was really surprised to read, and you think about an athlete or somebody training a younger person as their bones and body are developing, but also adding more lean protein as you age. That was surprising because you would think that a growing body would be more apt to need more protein, especially like if you're very athletic. But I was surprised to see that even for aging adults.
It's not clear why that is, but there is emerging evidence that their protein requirement is higher in older adults. There's not quite a consensus yet to come up with a recommended daily allowance or these RDA equivalents that says, you know, somebody over 70 should be eating more protein. But there is emerging evidence that it's important. And it may be that the metabolic processes associated with aging change enough that they can't convert various other nutrients into the right kinds of protein, so that these protein supplements are important for maintaining muscle in older compared to younger people. So I think we'll probably see a lot more on that in the coming years and more specific recommendations.
Do they have like a program that's designed like, let's say, some balance, stretching, some weightlifting, a modest cardio? Because, you know, as people age, they develop problems like heart disease or diabetes. Is this just something that should be done under a supervision of a doctor? Or I suspect before you embark on a program like this, you might want to go get a physical.
Yeah, I would agree. If people have not been exercising and they suddenly are going to go into a more vigorous phase, and especially if they have any cardiovascular risk factors, smoking, diabetes, or high cholesterol, those individuals should get a quick okay from the physician and then probably have some supervision in their early parts of their exercise regimen. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a physician supervision, but somebody in the gym that would be able to kind of teach them how to use the equipment and make sure that their heart rate isn't racing out of control. And so that's usually a good way to get integrated or eased back into an exercise regimen.
Isn't there something like, for example, using a heart monitor so you find out you're not doing anything that's overstressing your heart or your heart gets too elevated? I mean, you know, we have all these things now, watches that can even count your steps, your calories, and also monitor your heart.
Yeah, that can be one way to monitor what happens to your heart as you exercise. And there are some set points, and usually they're on those pieces of equipment, you know, sort of weight. You can calibrate them for your weight, and there's a little grip on most of the machines where you put your hand on that, and it calculates your heart rate. And it kind of gives you a range. So most people fit well within that range, and their heart's not racing away. But occasionally, some people might get a very fast heartbeat, feel uncomfortable, maybe a little short of breath, and that certainly can be related to a heartbeat that's too fast or some other abnormalities that might be going on with the heart. And those are the people that need to be in closer contact with physicians.
It's amazing because you do hear about stories. One that comes to mind is Jack LaLanne. I think he was in his 90s and still looked like a bodybuilder. So this is something that you can do at any age. I mean, is there any restrictions? I mean, if you're getting in your late 70s and 80s, is it more risk? Or is it something if you start early enough, you can stay with?
I can't think of any risk unless people have specific heart conditions. There was just a very large study published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, called the LIFE Study. And these were older people in their 70s, 80s, and even up into their 90s who were not very physically active. And it prescribed increased levels of activity. And they did well. They had a relatively low progression of disease states. They didn't become disabled at the same rate as the other population that wasn't doing these activities. So I think any age and any health status, some level of activity is beneficial, and even up into nursing home patients in their 90s. Now, the caveat there again, though, is people with known cardiovascular disease and known risk factors, those people should be more closely supervised. And people with joint problems, it's just a good idea not to overstress certain joints. If people are having severe pain and exercise is aggravating it, then I think the exercise needs to be shifted away from that joint, and that needs to be evaluated by a medical professional. But again, there are very little contraindications to increasing levels of activity, and I think the recommendation is always to kind of start slow, but keep doing it, keep at it, and gradually increase as much as you can tolerate. And if you need a professional to help you in a gym setting, that's often a very good way to go. It kind of gets people eased back into a more active lifestyle.
I didn't realize also that even the pharmaceutical industry is coming up with drugs that can ease or stop a protein or something that has a lot to do with this loss.
There are some agents that drug companies are working on, just like their drugs that treat osteoporosis or osteopenia, loss of bone. There are several categories of drugs that people are trying now to prevent the loss of skeletal muscle. And they're mostly in the hormone category, so they act on receptors in muscle, and that tends to turn them back more towards a normal, younger phenotype where they're more likely to be able to respond to nutrients and exercise and grow appropriately instead of just kind of stalling out and declining. So there are drugs in clinical trials. There's nothing ready for prime time yet, but I'm sure within 5 years there'll be things on the market.
If you were to describe an overall regimen as you age, let's say you start getting in your 40s, maybe start a regimen of regular exercise, whether that's cardio, incorporate some weightlifting, because if you want to build muscle, you're going to have to do some strength training. But doctor, sounds like this is something that somebody can begin at any age. Obviously, there'd be some restrictions based on health. But it's something that you can do, you know, whether you're in your 40s, 50s, or 60s, or 70s.
Absolutely. It's never too late. And people should, if they have an inactive lifestyle, that is highly correlated with more likely to become disabled, more likely to have chronic illnesses, lower quality of life, less happiness with aging, all sorts of things. So it's never too late. And if people haven't been exercising, we always encourage them to start slowly, do a few things, and just gradually pick it up. And oftentimes it helps to do it with a friend or a family member just to kind of reinforce and encourage each other to get moving.
In the medical profession, have you found any particular exercise? Like, we live close to a retirement community, and there's a lot of yoga studios, Pilates studios that emphasize not only stretching, breathing, balance. Is there anything you have found in your studies that are more beneficial?
No, I think a balanced approach, especially as people get older, using all the approaches, you need to maintain some cardiovascular fitness with aerobic type exercise. You need to strengthen all of your muscle groups, really, especially shoulders and hip area. So those muscles that enable you to rise up out of a chair, those are really important if you think about people in their 80s and becoming more likely to be disabled. As long as people can pop up out of the chair and walk, then they're much more likely to be able to stay at home and stay in their own settings. So muscles strengthening exercises that do that would be good. And then finally, these balance exercises. I come back to Tai Chi, which is, you know, not common across America, but certainly known. You know, if you've seen these pictures of older Chinese residents in parks doing those sort of balance things early in the morning, that has been shown again and again to improve lower extremity function and prevent falls. So I would try to incorporate all of those things into an exercise regimen: aerobics, muscle strength training, and some kind of balance exercises like Tai Chi.
Doctor, are you aware of any books that incorporate the things that we're talking about? I mean, you can go to a bookstore and you can take a look under health and fitness. They have bodybuilding books. They have all kinds of things. But anything specifically geared more towards, let's say, somebody that's more in the senior or retirement age?
You know, there's not a lot of good resources out there right now. That's something that we've been thinking about working on, so we may be able to have something out in a year or two. But right now, I can't think of any off the top of my head. There may be something out there, but it's certainly a great idea and a resource that people definitely ask for all the time. So I think my team here, we're thinking about doing that, and your statement encourages me further to get moving.
Yeah, because I've had trainers, and I found the older trainers are more astute and more attuned to somebody, let's say, in my age than, let's say, somebody younger. And when you go to the bookstore looking for health exercises or books on health, they got these pictures of men in their 20s, women in their 20s. You don't see too many with people in their 60s or 70s or geared more specifically towards somebody in the retirement age bracket. So it'd be great to see a book out there like that.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Yeah, and the ones we're thinking about would also incorporate the nutritional recommendations and the comment on the protein issues that you're talking about. And also management of chronic diseases. I think that that is more and more being recognized as a crucial component of maintaining health as you get older, is keep on top of disease state. So if somebody has diabetes, you know, to control it, to make sure that it's not kind of running out of control, or congestive heart failure, something like that, make sure that the disease state is tightly managed, because then people tend to do better longer term and are more likely to stay functional and enjoy life to much later years.
I would think too, doctor, that changing your diet, eating a more healthy diet, let's say vegetables, lean proteins, exercise, can also go a long way towards reversing some of these diseases, or at least putting a lot of them into remission, if not getting rid of them.
Yeah, type 2 diabetes is a good example of that. This is more probably from younger people, but younger obese people who tend to drift into diabetes, their sugar levels go up as they get more obese. Losing 10 or 15 pounds and exercising can make a huge difference. It can make a difference between having to go on medication or even insulin or not. So, and that particular disease, exercise is amazingly important. And even they've shown with people with advanced lung disease, they've smoked for many years and they have emphysema, or what we call COPD. Some mild exercise regimens also can strengthen their diaphragm and their ability to breathe. And so many disease states, even their cardiac rehab programs after people have had heart attacks, they encourage activity, supervised activity, where that kind of helps kind of get them back in shape and helps manage the disease state in the end. So, yeah, I would agree that exercise can really help manage chronic disease states.
So, doctor, the long and short of it is stay healthy, eat well, do some exercise, cardio strengthening, incorporate that, make it part of your lifestyle. It can make a whole big difference in retirement. I'm always amazed that people will sit and plan for retirement. They save, they've worked hard, but then they get there and their health fails them because they didn't take care of themselves while they were trying to take care of their finances.
I think people are getting the message. Younger people, I think it's kind of been part of the culture. The obesity epidemic has derailed that a bit. You know, as people have become more and more obese in our country, that has definitely kind of slowed down the trajectory of staying healthy later in life. But despite that, people, you know, they know exercise is on the radar screen, and people after retirement are kind of picking it up and sticking with it. So I would just say, if you're doing it, great. If you're not doing it, please get started and start slow and move up. It helps everybody. So it's the best thing we have right now in geriatrics.
Well, listen, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Some great advice. And thank you so much for being a part of the program today.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. And remember, you know, so many of the things that we talk about here on the program, not just planning for retirement or getting yourself in shape when you retire, but staying healthy. Think about it. You spend your whole life working, saving, you're getting ready to retire. Why not make it one of the best periods of your life, your golden years, where you can enjoy it in good health? And remember, as the doctor just said, the earlier you can start, make it part of your regimen, the healthier it'll be in the long run. Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us this week. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.